And in the coming days, you will see the committee move on to President Trump's broader planning for January 6th, including his plan to corrupt the Department of Justice and his detailed planning with lawyer John Eastman to pressure the vice president, state legislatures, state officials, and others to overturn the election. Let me leave you today with one clip to preview what you will see in one of our hearings to come. This is the testimony of White House lawyer Eric Hirschman. John Eastman called Mr. Hirschman the day after January 6th, and here is how that conversation went.
I said to him, "Are you out of your effing mind?" Right? I said, "I only want to hear two words coming out of your mouth for now on: orderly transition."
That's former White House lawyer Eric Hirschman. We'll be live streaming all the January 6th hearings at democracynow.org. You can tune in on Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern and then on Thursday at 1 p.m. Then we will bring you highlights on Thursday and Friday of those hearings on Democracy Now! On Monday, we'll be airing a Juneteenth special. We'll talk to Clint Smith on the origins of Juneteenth and his book, How the Word is Passed, A Reckoning with the History of Slavery Across America. And we'll also speak with MIT professor Craig Stephen Wilder, author of Ebony and Ivy, Race, Slavery, and the Troubled History of America's Universities. That does it for our show. To see transcripts, audio, and video podcasts, go to democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced with Renee Feltz, Mike Burke, Dina Guzder, Messiah Woods, Nermeen Sheikh, Maritia Sena, Tammy Warrenoff, Camille Baker, Sharina Nadura, Sam Alkoff, Tamari Astudio, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Honey Masood, Mary Kama, Juan Carlos Davila. Our executive director is Julie Crosby. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM in the Portland area, and all over the world at KBOO.FM.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at KBOO.FM. Due to the temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Finance Committee meets the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify that a meeting is
being June held. Is Pride Month. Show your support for the LGBTQ plus community and KBOO programming by wearing the special limited edition KBOO Loves All Frequencies Pride t-shirt. Get yours now at kboo.fm/pride.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, the Democratic primary for Oregon House Seat 38 is finally called. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler announces aggressive houseless sweeps citywide. And in international news, a new report exposes the true oppressive conditions China's Uyghur community faces. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 14th, 2022. I'm Althea Billings. The Democratic primary in Oregon House District 38 has at long last been called in favor of Lake Oswego City Councilor Daniel Nguyen. Nguyen beat his opponent, school board member Neelam Gupta, by just 28 votes. The count in the election was long delayed because of problems with Clackamas County's election process. Smeared printing on the barcodes of tens of thousands of ballots meant that many ballots had to be counted by hand. If Nguyen had received one less vote, an automatic recount would have been triggered because of that narrow margin. Gupta would have the option of requesting a recount, but on Monday night she indicated that she would accept the results of the race. Nguyen will face Republican Alistair Furman in the November general election. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler intends to take large houseless camp sweeps citywide, according to reporting from Oregon Live. Wheeler called for unprecedented sweeps in Old Town earlier this year and now intends to take this strategy to the whole city. Wheeler called the sweeps a success in Old Town at a press conference on Monday. The city says they connected people who were swept with shelters and resources, but according to unhoused folks in the area, they were never contacted by outreach workers and mainly moved their tents to the Pearl District. Houseless advocates stress that sweeps are traumatizing to unhoused people and actually impede their ability to access resources and stabilize their living conditions. The January 6th committee held its second hearing yesterday, and gun control proposals gained new support. With more on these stories, it's Jonah Chester with 2022 Talks.
Welcome to 2022 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
This morning, we'll tell the story of how Donald Trump lost an election and knew he lost an election, and as a result of his loss, decided to wage an attack on our democracy.
Mississippi Democratic Representative Benny Thompson kicked off the second public hearing of the January 6th committee Monday. The focus was on former President Donald Trump's big lie, claiming the election was stolen. Backed by video testimony, Representative Liz Cheney, a Wyoming Republican, said Trump ignored the advice of his own campaign and legal team, forging ahead with unfounded stolen election claims and attempts to disrupt the vote certification process.
The Trump campaign legal team knew there was no legitimate argument, fraud, irregularities, or anything to overturn the election.
In a pre-taped deposition, senior Trump campaign advisor Jason Miller alleged former New York Mayor Rudy Giuliani urged the president to double down on fraud allegations.
And the mayor was definitely intoxicated, but I do not know his level of intoxication when he spoke with the president, for example.
Former Trump administration Attorney General Bill Barr described the president's behavior as, quote, detached from reality.
There was never an indication of interest in what the actual facts were.
Now to gun reform. Republican Representative Tony Gonzalez, who represents Uvalde, Texas, the scene of a school shooting that left 21 dead, said he supports the bipartisan gun control framework released by Senate negotiators. He likes the mental health aspects of the bill, but said he's reluctant to back its red flag law provisions. Red flag laws allow people to petition courts to confiscate firearms from high-risk individuals.
The last thing I want to do is circumvent individual rights and circumvent due process. So that's where I pump the brakes on red flags.
The framework would provide financial incentives to encourage states to adopt red flag laws, but would not mandate them. The formal text for the gun control bills hasn't been introduced. As the Supreme Court weighs the future of abortion access, New York on Monday became the latest state to fortify its abortion access policies. Politico reports the new laws will, among other things, increase protections for those seeking an abortion and bar the extradition of abortion providers to other states for criminal prosecution, except in cases where they fled from the state seeking their extradition. And President Joe Biden has signed a bill to kick off the initial planning phases of a new National Museum of Asian American History. Vice President Kamala Harris says the museum will represent an important piece of American history.
To teach this history is to help all of us as Americans understand where we come from.
I'm Jonah Chester for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
Key stock indicators declined yesterday into bear market territory. With more on what that means, it's KBOO's Josh Salem.
The United States S&P 500 index is back in a bear market for the first time in 2 years. A bear market is typically the term used by Wall Street when a stock index like the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones Industrial Average, or sometimes an individual stock, has fallen 20% or more from a recent high for a sustained period of time. In this case, the S&P 500, Wall Street's main index, just fell 3.9%. It's 21.8% below its record set earlier this year, qualifying us as being in a bear market. Other important indices are significantly down as well. The Dow Industrial sank 2.8%, and the tech-heavy NASDAQ Composite which already was in a bear market, fell 4.7%. The last bear market for the S&P 500 was very brief. It ran from February 19, 2020 through March 23, 2020, the shortest bear market ever. But the index fell 34% in that one-month period. A bear market largely means investors are backing away from purchasing stocks. This is likely occurring for many reasons, including the fact the inflation rate is the highest it has been in decades. Experts believe the war in Ukraine, rising interest rates, and a slowdown in China's economy are also making buyers nervous. The Federal Reserve had taken actions in the last 5 years, which previously buoyed up stock prices. Now it has moved away from propping up financial markets in the economy, partially through maintaining record low interest rates, and it is focused on fighting inflation. Its key short-term interest rate was at a record low near zero, which encouraged investors to move their money into riskier assets like stocks or cryptocurrencies to get better returns. Now, experts feel interest rate increases of double the usual amount are likely in upcoming months. Consumer prices are at their highest levels in 4 decades and rose nearly 9% in May compared with a year ago. The moves by the Federal Reserve are designed to slow the economy by making it more expensive to borrow. The biggest danger is that this could cause a recession if interest rates go up too high or too quickly. Stocks have declined almost 35% on average when a bear market coincides with a recession, compared with a nearly 24% drop when the economy is able to avoid the recession, per Ryan Dietrich, chief market strategist at LPL Financial. Advisors do note Wall Street has some of its best days either during a bear market or just after the end of one. That includes two separate instances in the middle of the 2000 to 2009 bear market where the S&P 500 surged roughly 11%, as well as gains of better than 9% during and shortly after the 2020 bear market. The S&P 500 has come back from every one of its prior bear markets to eventually rise to another all-time high. Advisors do, however, suggest putting money into stocks only if it won't be needed for several years. On average, bear markets have taken 13 months to go from peak to trough and 27 months to get back to break even since World War II. The S&P 500 index has fallen an average of 33% during bear markets in that time. The biggest decline occurred in the 2007 to 2009 market when the S&P 500 fell 57%. The longest bear market lasted 61 months and ended in March of 1942. Then the index fell by 60%. For KBOO News, I'm Josh Salem.
Recent mass shootings have put gun violence in focus across the nation. The impact of these shootings stretches far beyond just the victims, including to healthcare workers. Eric Tegedoff has the story.
People across the nation are continuing to discuss gun violence in the wake of two prominent mass shootings in Texas and New York. The conversation brings up painful memories for communities that have experienced them in the past, and a reminder that this violence hurts a wide circle of people, including healthcare professionals. Linda Pond is president of the Oregon Nurses Association and was working at a Springfield hospital when a shooter killed 2 and injured 25 at a nearby school in Eugene.
You can't just look at the immediate impact of something. You have to look at the long-term impact, not just on families, but every person whose lives is touched. Be it a doctor, be it a nurse, be it a social worker, be it a minister, be it the psychologist that takes care of them 20 years later as they're processing their PTSD.
Victims of the 1998 shooting at Thurston High School were brought to Pond's Hospital. She spoke in Washington, D.C. last Friday at a media event before the weekend's March for Our Lives rallies across the nation. On Sunday, U.S. senators announced they'd reached a bipartisan deal on a number of gun safety laws. Pond again was on duty in 2015 when another shooter killed 9 at a community college in Roseburg. Several of the victims were transferred to her hospital. She knows people who have been personally impacted by gun violence, especially at the Springfield incident, and who feel the anguish every time a shooting happens.
A lot of folks that are victims of these traumas can't be active in sport because the pain is too deep. It's too real. So then it becomes the responsibility of those of us that have seen it, that are not that immediately impacted, to take our experiences and their experiences forward and share the stories.
Pond hopes lawmakers can set aside their differences to ensure gun violence doesn't take any more victims.
This shouldn't be a political issue. This is a humanitarian issue.
For Oregon News Service, I'm Eric Tegedoff.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for Making Contact, Reexamining When the Romance Writers of America Had Their Own Racial Reckoning. Stick around at 7 for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be cloudy with a low of 51 degrees. Tomorrow, those clouds continue with a high of 72. A flood warning from the National Weather Service is in effect until Wednesday night for the Columbia River near Vancouver. Residents in both Multnomah and Clark counties are advised to use caution when walking near riverbanks. Today in history, in 1919, John Alcock and Arthur Witten Brown depart from St. John's, Newfoundland to complete the first successful transatlantic flight. The quote of the day is from artist and inventor Leonardo da Vinci, who said, quote, "Once you have tasted flight, you will forever walk the earth with your eyes turned skyward, for there you have been, and there you will always long to return." The nation's safety net community health centers want Congress to stop Big Pharma from throwing up roadblocks to a federal discounted medicine program known as 340B. Contrary to industry claims, 92% of the nation's 1,400 health centers use 340B to increase access for low-income and rural patients. That's according to a new report. Eric Galatis has more in Colorado.
Colorado's community health centers are joining a national effort pushing back against Big Pharma's recent moves that make it harder to provide discounted medicines to people living in severe poverty. Pueblo Community Health Center CEO Don Moore says a federal program known as 340B has helped more of Pueblo's Latino community, who experience much higher rates of chronic disease and more barriers to accessing primary health care.
We're totally fulfilling the purpose of the legislation, which is to stretch our public funding as far as it can go to reach the people most in need, which in our case includes minority populations.
Over the past 2 years, drug producers and third-party prescription drug benefit managers have been throwing up barriers to the 340B program, according to a new report calling on Congress to add new protections. The industry has claimed that discounted medicines are being diverted to patients not eligible under 340B or that savings aren't being used to expand access. Moore notes the law has a dispute resolution process for determining if health centers are not doing what they're supposed to do, but drug companies and benefit managers are acting unilaterally, adding restrictions and new rules that limit access to discounted medicines at community health centers and their contracted pharmacies.
They've tried to whittle away at that and keep more of the money in their pockets than allow those savings to flow down to safety net providers like community health centers to make sure people have access to medicines that are important to good outcomes for the patients.
The report found that 92% of the nation's 1,400 health centers use 340B savings to increase access for low-income and or rural patients. Moore points to a new clinic that opened in January, which has added 300 to 400 new patients each month, and 6 school-based clinics, all made possible in part through savings under 340B.
These clinics are important access point to adolescents and young adults, but they do not operate on a profitable basis, and we utilize savings from the 340B program to ensure those access points can stay open.
This is Eric Galatis reporting for the Colorado News Connection.
The Supreme Court rules that Native Americans who are tried in tribal court can be tried again in federal court based on the same incident. With that story and more, it's Art Hughes with National Native News.
This is National Native News. I'm Art Hughes, in for Antonio Gonzalez. Native Americans prosecuted in tribal court can be prosecuted again in federal court. That's the ruling by the U.S. Supreme Court this week. The case involves Merle Dinesby, a citizen of the Navajo Nation. He was accused of rape but was convicted of assault and battery in what's known as a Court of Indian Offenses, a consortium of several Native nations that might not individually have the capacity to tackle court cases. Following his conviction, he was released after serving less than 5 months in jail. Typically, tribal courts can impose sentences of less than a year. He was then subjected to another trial for the same offense in federal court. There, he was convicted of rape and sentenced to 30 years in prison. His lawyers argued the second trial amounted to double jeopardy. The majority Supreme Court decision, however, concluded DeNesby's separate trials were for violations of both a tribal ordinance and federal law, which are two separate things. Justice Neil Gorsuch, though, is among the three dissenting judges, saying the case involved the same crime and same prosecuting authority, and the majority's ruling is, quote, at odds with the text and original meaning of the Constitution. Tribal officials are putting their support behind a bill to permanently ban new uranium mining near Grand Canyon National Park. They gave their testimony at a U.S. Senate subcommittee hearing. Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, for decades, Southwest tribes have been some of the most outspoken opponents of mining in the area.
The Grand Canyon Protection Act would make permanent a 2012 moratorium put in place by the Obama administration on new claims throughout more than a million acres near the park. The Senate Subcommittee on Public Lands, Forests, and Mining heard from supporters of the legislation. Havasupai Chairman Thomas Seyuja Sr. submitted written testimony calling for the protection of the area's groundwater and urged passage of the bill. The Havasupai tribe lives in the Grand Canyon and has resisted uranium mining for decades. They say it could threaten their land, sole water source, and very existence. In addition, Seyuja said one uranium mine less than 10 miles from the south rim of the Grand Canyon endangers Red Butte, a sacred site to the Havasupai and an origin point of the tribe's creation story. Advocates for the bill, including Arizona Senators Mark Kelly and Kyrsten Sinema, who sponsored the legislation, say the more than 600 active uranium claims near the canyon could eventually turn into mines without a permanent ban. The U.S. House of Representatives passed the Grand Canyon Protection Act last year. The uranium industry says new mining methods are safe and won't contaminate area aquifers. For National Native News, I'm Ryan Heinches in Flagstaff.
U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen is planning a visit to the Rosebud Sioux Tribe in South Dakota. The in-person appearance is intended to highlight the benefits of the Rosebud's portion of the federal America Rescue Plan money to offset the effects of the pandemic. One tribal official told Reuters the $191 million in ARPA money was a lifesaver for the tribe. Officials say much of the money will go toward building affordable housing for tribal members living on the reservation. Reuters reports there's no record of any Treasury secretary visiting any Native reservation. Minneapolis indigenous restaurant Awamni won the restaurant world's highest honor. The James Beard Foundation awarded the restaurant the best restaurant in the nation at a ceremony at the Lyric Opera in Chicago. Chef Sean Sherman says he hopes the award helps to encourage more indigenous restaurant openings.
When we opened up, we coined the term hashtag 86 colonialism because it was really a statement because a lot of us, people of color from everywhere, have been affected by colonialism, and we just went through centuries of racist bullshit. This is showing that we can get through that, that we're still here.
Sherman opened the restaurant on the banks of the Mississippi River in Minneapolis in 2021 with co-owner Dana Thompson. Sherman received a previous James Beard Award for his cookbook, The Sioux Chef's Indigenous Kitchen. With National Native News, I'm Art Hughes.
New hacked data gives an unprecedented look at the Uyghur oppression continuing in China's Xinjiang province. But how will the international community react? Now we go to a global citizen commentary on the issue from Portland State Professor Emeritus Mel Gertov. The opinions expressed in the following piece are those of the speaker.
Thanks, and hello, everyone. A top United Nations official recently traveled to Xinjiang province in China, hoping to improve life for the roughly 1.5 million Uyghurs and other Chinese Muslims imprisoned there in one of the world's greatest human rights catastrophes. The repression in Xinjiang province, which I call a genocide, is a well-documented Chinese government policy authorized by the specific order of President and Communist Party leader Xi Jinping. On top of all the previous evidence of crimes against the Uyghurs, such as the testimony and documents presented late last year at the Uyghur Tribunal in London, we now have something unprecedented: hacked data known as the Xinjiang police files that contain images of more than 5,000 imprisoned Uyghurs, police spreadsheets, and confidential documents from two counties in Xinjiang. The data from internal police networks proves that so-called re-education camps are in fact internment centers, and that top Chinese leaders are directly responsible for creating them as part of a mass campaign to eradicate the Uyghur culture. The photographs also give us a look at the conditions that prisoners face in the centers, As Dr. Adrian Zenz, a leading authority on the camps, says, we have images of actual police drills showing how police are handcuffing detainees, shackling them, marching them off, and then even putting them into the ominous tiger chair for interrogation. Michelle Bachelet, the UN's High Commissioner for Human Rights, has been sitting for many months on a report on Chinese policy in Xinjiang. Many observers, especially people in Uyghur overseas communities and human rights organizations, have eagerly anticipated her report. Rather than release it, Bachelet recently spent 6 days in China, including two in Xinjiang, at the invitation of Xi Jinping's government. Though initially her office suggested the trip was an investigation, at its end she denied that, saying its chief purpose was direct discussions with a view to supporting China in fulfilling its obligations under international human rights law. In a public recounting, she complimented the Chinese leadership for its cooperation, lauded its social and economic achievements, and assured one and all that she had raised troubling human rights issues with senior Chinese officials. Considering Bachelet's background as a victim of torture in the Pinochet era in Chile, she was surely aware that visiting a country under authoritarian rule is a potential trap. She had no real control over such a trip's most important item, the agenda. Indeed, Bachelet reported she was, quote, unable to assess the full scale of the so-called vocational education centers in Xinjiang, that is, the internment facilities, but was assured they had been dismantled. She spoke with civil society groups, jurists, and legal authorities, all no doubt handpicked to reflect the views of the party state. She also said she had raised a number of concerning issues with the Chinese government, such as allegations of the use of force and ill treatment of prisoners. She encouraged the Chinese government to ensure that those measures conformed with international human rights laws. China actually has signed but not ratified the UN Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, as she pointed out. In all, her trip turned out to be a propaganda coup for Beijing. The visit was a classic Potemkin village experience in which the authorities kept Bachelet away from the victims of abuse and presented a false front to hide actual conditions. Of course she could not assess the full scale of the internment camps, nor did she have any way to look into other aspects of Chinese policy, such as forced labor, separation of families, and deployment of prison labor to other provinces. With little to say about the scope of the repression, she could not challenge China's official narrative that justifies its abuses in the name of counterterrorism. Even though the Chinese supposedly agreed to maintain a dialogue on the Uyghurs, rest assured, any such dialogue will be just as one-sided if it occurs at all. One might excuse Ms. Bachelet's decision to go to China on the grounds that she could present the world community's concerns about the Uyghurs directly to Chinese leaders. She did so, but not in a way that has any hope of improving life for the Uyghurs. As the representative of the world community and apparently a candidate for UN Secretary General, she should not have put herself in a position to be used by a regime that is eminently successful at hiding what it doesn't want outsiders or even its own people to see. Besides, what could possibly be learned in 2 days of a guided tour in Xinjiang? Imagine accepting an invitation from Vladimir Putin to evaluate war crimes in Ukraine by spending 2 days in Crimea. This trip was an embarrassment, both personal and institutional, symbolized by a presentation to Bachelet of a book of Xi's thoughts on protecting human rights. She should have given the Chinese the Xinjiang police files in return, and she should immediately release the report on Chinese policy. I'm Mel Gertov for The Global Citizen. Thanks very much for listening.
Dentists say people should reach for water, not sports drinks, when they're exercising this summer. Nadia Ramlagan has more on the benefits of staying away from sugary sports drinks in North Carolina.
Reach for water instead of sports drinks to stay hydrated. That's the message North Carolina dentists have for residents this summer. Studies have ranked sugary and highly acidic sports and energy drinks as among the worst for oral health. Durham-based dentist Dr. Mary Gaddis says it's a common misconception that sports drinks are healthy. She explains people often sip on these types of beverages over the course of several hours while doing outdoor sports or hanging at the beach, which can set the stage for cavities.
So you're constantly coating your teeth with that acid and with that sugar. And so over that period of time, the acid is going to weaken the enamel on your teeth and make them more susceptible to decay.
She adds that if you need an extra flavor boost beyond water, bananas and nuts are a good source of carbohydrates and potassium for energy. And says coconut water can provide essential minerals like sodium, calcium, phosphorus, and magnesium. Gaddis also says oral hygiene habits tend to fall off the wagon during the summer among kids, and combined with the chugging of sports drinks can lead to enamel erosion, discoloration, tooth decay, and staining.
During the summer, they're off their routines, and so maybe they're not getting up and brushing in the morning like they normally would. They're staying up later, so they're not brushing at night before you go to bed.
She adds it's important to see your dentist regularly for checkups, even if you aren't experiencing symptoms.
And you definitely need a dentist to check to see what's happening, because most of the time, you're not going to have any sensitivity. You're not going to have any pain or discomfort from a normal cavity. So if you're having pain or discomfort, usually that's beyond the level of just a regular cavity.
In addition to teeth, there's also evidence sports drinks can impact overall health. Research has shown frequent consumption of sports drinks can lead to obesity among children and young adults. This is Nadia Ramlagan for North Carolina News Service.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, June 14th, 2022. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast includes Josh Salem and Mel Gertov. The producer is Althea Billings, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Art Hughes, Jonah Chester, Eric Tegadoff, Eric Galatis, and Nadia Ramlagan. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are supported by our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321.